Lots more to talk with Colin Dickey about, The Unidentified, his latest book, which has just come out, but we'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Colin Dickey with us. His book is called The Unidentified, and we will take your calls this hour as well. Colin, let's talk about a fellow by the name of Paul Benowitz and the involvement with Majestic 12, which had to do with a committee that investigated and looked at UFOs, and there were strange documents. I remember Stanton Friedman, the late Stanton Friedman, talking with us about that. But what did you uncover?
This was one of the weirdest stories. I literally couldn't believe this when I was researching this. So this guy, Paul Benowitz, he's an Air Force contractor. He's got a house that butts up against Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, and he goes out on the roof every night, and he sees these weird flying things out over the Air Force Base. You know, these things he can't quite explain. So he's taking photos. He's taking videos. He's showing them to other people in the UFO networks, and the government, you know, starts getting a little nervous because here's a guy, here's a civilian taking photographs of unidentified flying objects over the Air Force base in, you know, top secret airspace. And so what's crazy is this guy was a veteran. He was a patriotic citizen. He worked for, you know, his company worked for the government. He obviously, you know, supported what they did. They could have called him in. They could have said, look, you know, what you saw was, you know, I don't know, it's classified military technology. We can't talk about it, but could you please just not, you know, could you please stop taking photographs of it? That seemed to me the easiest thing to do. Instead, what they decided to do was they decided to pump him full of just crazy nonsense. So they gave him this computer. They're like, this computer has been receiving extraterrestrial messages. We thought maybe you could decode it. So and then they broadcast just gibberish from across the street out of this Air Force base. So he's just, you know, getting these weird gibberish codes that then he's desperately trying to uncover. And he, you know, I don't know what his mental state was before all this happened, but they basically more or less drive this guy crazy. They keep kind of feeding him these fake documents and these sort of weird conspiracies that they're basically making up whole cloth. I mean, so, you know, there's some truth in some of the stories and some of the stuff we don't know, but we also know that the Air Force was basically inventing a bunch of stuff with the sole purpose of kind of corrupting Paul Benowitz's mental state so that nobody would believe, you know, what he was saying about what he was actually seeing. Nobody would take those photographs, those eyewitness accounts seriously if everybody just thought he was crazy. So they just spent years, and he, you know, according to some reports, he ended up being institutionalized at some point because he just kind of got filled with all these like crazy ideas that the Air Force were putting in his head, and it drove him nuts.
It pushed him over the edge, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he meets with this one woman who claims that, you know, she was abducted by aliens, and so, you know, he gets really excited about that. But it's not just like, I want to hear your story, or maybe, you know, go into hypnosis. He starts doing these crazy experiments with her where they have to interview her in his car because it's got to be on rubber so that, you know, the signal will be grounded, and he covers the whole car in aluminum foil to get the right conductivity. You know, he's doing these really bizarre experiments with this woman who claims to have been abducted, and they both kind of are kind of feeding his insanity. And, you know, guys who knew him before and after would describe, you know, you show up one year and you just, you know, have a couple beers and you talk about UFOs, and you show up 3 years later and he meets you at the door with a shotgun, and he, you know, hurries you in, and he starts talking about, you know, they're out to get me, and they're, you know, and all this stuff. And, you know, I mean, you could really see in real time, you know, the way that the Air Force managed to really kind of, you know, pervert and pollute his ideas so they could discredit him, which seems totally unnecessary. You could have just asked him to, you know, keep that stuff under wraps, I guess.
Colin, of everything you've probed, investigated, which has been the most fascinating story for you?
I mean, the ones that I think I keep coming back to are the ones that I just don't have a good, even if I wanted to be a real like skeptic debunker, I just don't have a good answer for. And I, you know, definitely the Kentucky meat shower ranks right up there. This idea that, you know, you know, what fell from the sky? Who knows? Another one that I really can't shake is the story out of Lawndale, Illinois in 1977. Marion Lowe is this woman who's out in the backyard with her six-year-old son. And these two giant birds, I'm sure a lot of you
the Thunderbirds, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and, you know, and it's like, I mean, if it's just like one guy out in the forest seeing something, you can think, well, I don't know, maybe he's just made it up or whatever. But, you know, like the way she's, you know, there's other kids playing. Other kids saw this bird swoop up and pick up her six-year-old. And you know, like, you know, it was this big thing. And so... you know, so this bird comes down, it picks up her six-year-old and carries it, you know, what, 20, 30 feet or something before dropping this kid. And, you know, she freaks out, she panics. I would if it happened to my kid.
Didn't she have a broom in her hand or something and she's swiping at the bird or something like that?
Exactly, yeah. She's trying to get it to, you know, let her kid go. And, you know, she files a police report or whatever, you know, whatever the appropriate report is. You know, they show her a bunch of birds. What could it be? And she finally decides, well, it was a condor, which is crazy because condors are scavengers. They don't go after live prey, even though they're
And they're big, but they're not that big.
They're not big. Yeah, they can pick up maybe like a couple pounds at most. They can't pick up a 40-pound child. And also, you know, at that time they're all but extinct, and the only condors there are in California. They're nowhere near Illinois. So, you know, it's like, I have no idea what happened, but I can't get it out of my head, you know, and I think those are the things that I by the end of the book, there's some stuff I was like, yeah, I don't know, that seemed a little sketchy, but there are a couple incidences in the Lawndale one and the meat shower and a couple others. I got to the end of the book and it's like, I just don't have any clue where to begin to answer this, and that's why I love that story.
Wasn't there a bizarre story that Charles Fort wrote about frogs falling from the sky?
And yeah.
We think maybe some kind of updraft swooped up some frogs that might have been in the water and then dropped them down later or something?
Yeah, oh, yeah. So frogs falling from the sky. I mean, that's it didn't just happen once. It happened a bunch of times, you know, and Fort catalogs a bunch of those. And yeah, I think if you ask most people, they will say what likely happened is a waterspout or a tornado, you know, moves over a pond or something, sucks up these frogs and then spits them out, and then they, you know, it looks like, you know, raining frogs. But I Charles Fort is right. He says right there, he's like, well, then where are the lily pads? Where are the sticks and, you know, the small rocks? Where's the mud? Where's all the other stuff that would have got sucked up, you know, out of a pond by a tornado? How is this tornado able to exclusively suck up frogs and spin them out? And, you know, so it's like the best case explanation still doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And,
great stories. Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to Joe in the Bronx to get us started. Hey, Joe.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guest, he mentioned a trip to Transylvania to see the last remnants of the Kentucky meat shower. Did he happen to do any research on, say, vampires?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I mean, I've done a bunch of research on vampires, but Transylvania University doesn't have a whole lot of connection to, you know, the vampire myths. It's in Lexington, Kentucky, and I think it's like the seventh or eighth oldest university in the country. It's right up there with like Harvard and Yale. It was founded a really long time ago, and so I think the name, what is Transylvania? It just means like across the woods, I think, is what the actual etymology of Transylvania means. And it was founded, I think, long before, you know, Stoker's Dracula or anybody really had any sort of, you know, interest in vampires. So, yeah. So unfortunately, yeah. Like I love vampires. I'd love to, you know, do another book on vampires, but that there's no real connection there, although it is a fascinatingly strange place to visit.
Did you come across any cemetery stories or anything like that?
Among other things that they have in the Monroe Musnick Museum, next to the meat, they have a mad stone. I don't know if your listeners know what this is. This is they used to use it to cure rabies. So it's basically the hairball from a cow's stomach, that has medicinal properties, and you could press it against a rabies wound and it would heal, heal rabies. Abraham Lincoln actually had his son treated with a madstone after he got bit by a dog. That's where the phrase "hair of the dog that bit you" comes from, actually. But it turns out that, you know, the Monroe Museum has the largest madstone. It's about 2 feet in diameter. They, you know, think of that coming out of a cow's stomach. So they have all sorts of like crazy stuff. They've got this anatomical wax, model of a woman's torso that was in a fire, and so it's all burned and disfigured. It's really gross. So,
at what the time period they call it a P.T. Barnum?
So P.T. Barnum is what, you know, like he gets going in the 1850s and 1860s, and yeah, he's really sort of part of that the kind of first era of what become known as dime museums, right? You know, this kind of place that would just kind of gather up and collect oddities of various kinds, and there's a dime museum in New Jersey in the 19 teens or whatever that's falling on hard times, and they need a new gimmick, and so they dig up these old stories about the Jersey Devil, this mythical supernatural creature that used to haunt the New Jersey Pine Barrens, and they think, well, that's a good gimmick. So they this dime museum in New Jersey, they got a kangaroo from like Buffalo, New York, and they painted stripes on it and stapled some wings onto its back. It's really horrible treatment of this animal. And then they would poke it with an electrical stick to make it jump around on stage.
Jeez.
And kind of scream and wail. And then they're like, hey, look, it's the Jersey Devil. I know, it's an awful story, just the way they treated this animal. And thankfully, it didn't last too long before they let the poor thing go back to the zoo where it came from and let it live out its life. But it was enough to really kind of re-trigger, people's fascination with the Jersey Devil. So that's another cryptid that made it into the book.
In that time period, weren't seances big things too?
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, so that's all the same time period. Yeah, I mean, I think that spiritualism really takes off in the United States in the 1840s through to about the 1890s or whatever. And it's that whole period of time when it's like it feels like everything is kind of up for grabs. People are just trying out everything. People trying out mesmerism. They're trying out seances. They're hunting for new creatures. The kind of first sightings of, unidentified flying objects over Chicago in the 1890s. And it's like, and it just seems like anything is possible, And so I think it's a really fascinating time frame to kind of, do the history, because there's all sorts of weird stuff going on and people aren't trying too hard to figure out exactly what it means. They're mostly just kind of trying to report on it and just kind of get a handle on it. And I think it's a cool period.
Let's go to Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello there, Barry.
Hey, George, always a pleasure, buddy. And listen, I've got a good question for Colin, but I just want to say real quick, great show. Ben Fuchs is always fun to listen to, and now Colin is really fascinating me too, George.
It sure is.
He's just really something. But anyway, Colin, you mentioned about 30 minutes ago, I heard you mention that they had discovered a new primate about 20 years ago. Do you know what the name of it is, or is it like an orangutan or a chimpanzee?
I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact name of it, but I do remember, yeah, it's sort of like a smaller orangutan, I want to say. I was at the cryptozoology conference in Portland, Maine. Some of you guys may know Lauren Colden, who runs the International Cryptozoology Museum, and he does a conference every year. And they had a primatologist who was talking about, how they discovered, this new primate. And I wish I could remember the name of it. But yeah, if you Google new primate, you should be able to find it.
It's called Pongo, isn't it?
What's it?
Pongo.
Is that the name of it?
Pongo Tapanulius.
Oh yeah, that sounds right. That sounds pretty accurate. Yeah.
Or also, they have two names for it. The other name is Tapanuli orangutan.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
How about that? It's a new great ape discovered. About 3 years ago, something like that.
Oh wow! So a lot more recently. Yeah. So they're still out there. They're still finding new species and new animals. And a great time.
Good question, Barry, indeed. How about ghosts? You haven't talked about ghosts yet.
Yeah, well, the last book I wrote was on ghosts, and So, yeah, so I was on your show, I guess, with Dave a couple of years ago, and we talked a lot about ghosts. But
that was Ghostland, wasn't it?
Yeah, Ghostland, an American history and haunted houses and haunted places. And I wanted to, basically went around the country looking at, you know, kind of famously haunted places. So I went to the Winchester Mystery House. I went to Salem, Massachusetts, the LaLaurie Mansion in New Orleans. And, I really wanted to kind of, you know, spend a lot of time in these weird haunted places and try and understand, like, you know, why are we fascinated? Why are we drawn to these things? You know, I mean, whether or not you believe that there is life after death, I think, if you've been in a weird place, you've been in a, you know, in an old mansion or an old hotel, you can really feel that vibe. And that was kind of weird, unsettling feeling that I wanted to kind of explore. So I basically spent 2 years basically just driving around the country, staying in weird, creepy old places and writing about it. It was a great time.
Next up, let's go to Jim in West Point, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program. Hi, Jim.
Hi, George. Great show as always.
Thank you, Colin, sir.
Can't wait to read the new book, and I'm hoping you can maybe tell me what the heck is going on right now. So the story starts about 3 weeks ago. I went to Southern Illinois to visit some family, and my family has a cemetery plot, like, way out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's surrounded by woods. It's like 5 miles out of town. If I'm there for 3 hours, I'm the only one there, right? So I'm looking at my family's plot, and I see a freshly dug grave maybe 30 feet away. So I walked over to see what the name was, and there were huge, I would say 15-inch fresh footprints on top of this grave with toes with a really weird deformed, like, large toe. So it really piqued my interest, and I happened to be traveling with a trail camera and with infrared night vision. So I looked in my car. I had two huge apples and some Good and Plenty candy. So there's a tree stump right by the grave. So, and I had actually photographic evidence. I photographed everything that I have as well. And I put these apples on top of this tree stump, and I surrounded it with some Good and Plenty's. I hid my camera maybe 15 feet away off a headstone that had a big flower pot on it. I dug it way down in the flower pot and pointed it at the apples and the candy. I left. They actually closed the gate at the cemetery at dusk, like at dark, like at 8 o'clock at night, and they open at 6 a.m. So I left my camera there all night. I came back at 6 a.m. the next day, right when she opened up the gate. I went up there. Everything was gone off the tree stump. So I'm so excited. I'm going to find out what took it. I've used this camera forever. I know how to use it really well. I went up. My camera was gone. It wasn't in the flower pot anymore.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, oh, somebody took my camera. Something's going on, right? So I'm walking around a little bit, and I see something maybe 30 feet away. I went over. It's my camera. Something had got into the flower pot, pulled it out, and threw it like 30 feet. I turned it around. It has fingerprints all over the night vision camera part, large fingerprints. I have no clue what's going on. I'm like, if it was a person, why wouldn't it keep my camera? It would have had to come in when the gate was closed, all of that. So I'm like, okay, game on, guy, right? So I come back later. I load the tree stump right before the gate was closed with more apples, some donuts, and I pour like 100 Good and Plenty, 100 candies all around the tree stump. And I find another place maybe 20 feet away, and I hide my camera.
I'm going to have you finish the story when we come right back, Jim, in just a moment. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk for a couple hours about how to cope during all these strange times we're living through. And then later on, Mark Hetzman joins us as we talk about the Big Book of Mars, why we have been obsessed since the beginning of time with the red planet. I'm looking forward to that. And welcome back to Coast, Colin Dickey with us, and we're talking about his work, The Unidentified. Let's go back to Jim in West Point, Pennsylvania. So, Jim, you're in this cemetery sprinkling Good and Plenty's all over the place. Pick it up from there.
I am. And I forgot to mention the first night when I came back and found my camera had been thrown, I went through my camera. There was a picture of me dropping off the camera and a picture of me picking it up, and in between a picture of dark sky where something had picked the camera out, picked the camera up, set off the motion detector of the sky, apparently as it threw it.
Wow.
Also to mention, the apples in the Good and Plenty completely gone, no sign of anything, not an apple peel, nothing. So something I believe had taken the food, it hadn't eaten it there. So the second night I came back, I loaded down the tree stump. I put like four big apples on it, a couple of white donuts, and some Good and Plenty's all around the tree stump again. And I also bought a huge flower arrangement, and I put it on a headstone maybe 15 feet away, and I hid it deeply into the flowers of the head of the arrangement. I waited until the person come to lock the gate, and I turned everything on, and I left with them. I was right back at 6 a.m. the next morning. I come up, everything was gone. And there was not a single trace of an apple peel, a donut, nothing. Everything was gone. So again, it had taken, whatever it had taken, I believe, right? I looked, my camera was still there. I was so happy it didn't take my camera this time. So when I went up, I went through the pictures immediately, nothing.
Nothing.
A picture of me dropping it off and a picture of me picking it up. I have since tested the camera. It picked up a cat from 20 yards away at night. So whatever this is, it's not taking a picture of it.
What's your gut tell you?
The food. I'm wondering if you could tell me what the heck is going on, because I'm going back, and I'm going to find a way with like three cameras, and I'm going to try to catch a picture. Is there anything that you can help me with this?
I mean, you said that this was started by these weird footprints. Did you ever find any other footprints other than that first time?
No, and what's interesting is this was like a freshly dug grave. The first two footprints had gone like 6 inches into the dirt. I'm 250 pounds. I stood on that. I couldn't even hardly make a foot impression. So whatever it was so heavy, it went down. And the very last one captured the pictures of all the toes before it sunk.
But it was just that one set. It wasn't like they were leading off anywhere.
It was just that one set, and then some really weird fingerprints on my camera, which I never touched the lens of my camera. Some really weird fingerprints on my camera as well. And
gosh, I had no idea. That's really strange. I mean, because you would think if something was capable of leaving those footprints, it would.
You'd capture it on film.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you'd find other footprints somewhere else. It's not like you just hopped on that one grave and then found it off or something. That's a crazy story. It's really strange.
What's your gut tell you, Colin?
My gut tells me that you should go back with more cameras and see what you can find. I'm stumped. You got me. I don't know where that food would go if it wasn't like something had to take that food, right?
Do ghosts like Good and Plenty?
that's a great question to ask the next time you're in a seance. I noticed it's all really sweet food. Maybe you should leave something, like a beef jerky stick or something. See if they only like sugar, whatever it is.
That's wins. Thanks, Jim. Great story. Weird story.
Yeah, bizarre.
You could write another book just with these stories that you're getting.
Oh, yeah.
We've got Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Colin. Two quick questions. One would be, talking about the theme of animals, which is interesting, a Thunderbird story, but you could picture maybe lions coming after you and then bears and wolves all separately and all with the same goal. Then also you hear maybe of bears helping people, and certainly I've heard or read a couple of stories about dolphins actually rescuing people that off a sunken boat, even I think in World War II. So how do you kind of bring those two disparate themes together there? And then just the idea you said this civilization, I'm not so sure about that, because I just happenstance on talk radio, and some woman was on the outskirts of L.A., and she drove home late at night, and she said, Mulholland Drive, there was a movie there she was talking about that they made with that name. But she said there were three coyotes at midnight that just stopped her car, wouldn't let her continue. And then I talked to a relative based out of Portland, and he talked about how Vegas, once you go right outside that area, you're really into the wild. So is civilization somewhat of a mirage even here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I found when I kind of tried to add up all these different stories together is they always seem to be right on the edge of civilization, right? You know, it's always like the desert, you know, like it's, you know, Area 51 out in the Nevada desert, or, you know, the California desert, or it's, you know, the forest, you know, the forest in Northern California with the redwoods. It's always sort of right on the edge of things, you know, and I think that we tend to be drawn really to those kind of spaces that are kind of what you're talking about. They're like, you know, it's just outside of civilization, just where civilization ends. That's where the weird stuff happens. You know, that's where the kind of magic happens. And I think, you know, if I had to describe what this book is about in one sentence, I would say it's about what happens in those edges of civilization, the kind of frontier lands and the borderlands. Because you're right, that's where the weird stuff happens. That's where things start to get a little strange. The answer to your other question, I don't know. I don't know about animals in that sense, in the sense that, other than to say that I think there's just so much about the animal world that we just really don't know. And I think we pride ourselves on being kind of smarter than, you know, other animal species, that I'm not always sure that's true. And I don't always think we have a really clear understanding of why other animals do what they do. But I think it's totally fascinating. And for me, you know, it's a fair amount of humility that, you know, we're not alone on this earth, and we share with these other species that, you know, have a lot to teach us.
Colin, how did you pick the stories that you selected for the book?
Yeah, I went through a lot. I just kind of cast a wide, wide net, and I tried to pick those things that I couldn't quite figure out. I couldn't quite debunk in some way, you know, like the Lawndale incident and the meat shower. But I also tried to pick those things that would kind of show the history, you know, like in the final result, what I wanted to do is kind of tell a story about, you know, the kind of historical evolution of how we thought about these things, of how, you know, the evolution of how we conceive of aliens seems to have changed over the years, and, you know, how our fascination with cryptids has evolved. So I kind of looked for those things that would be kind of, you know, an important kind of turning point in the history of this stuff.
How many didn't make it, as we would say, hit the cutting room floor?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot. This book, I ended up writing about two extra books worth of stuff that got cut from this. So, you know, one of the things that I found really fascinating that I couldn't quite get in the book is, you know, we're talking about Lawndale, we're talking about Thunderbirds, and there's a theory that, you know, the Plains Native Americans have lots of stories of Thunderbirds. And one of the things that I thought was really cool is it may be the case that that what had happened is they had discovered pterodactyl fossils and fossils of dinosaurs that they couldn't explain. So they made up these stories about the Thunderbirds to sort of explain these, you know, the archaeological record and the dinosaur fossils that they'd found. So some cool stuff like that. I didn't have time to get into the alien big cats, which was another thing I really liked, this idea that, you know, there are you know, normal creatures, you know, jaguars and pumas and whatever, but they're hidden in places we wouldn't expect them to be in England or in, you know, Italy or something like that. You know, so that stuff got cut. There's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot out there. I just couldn't quite get it all in there.
And some of these cats have red eyes, don't they?
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. You know, the beast of the beast of Bonmore or something was a famous English alien big cat that nobody could explain. And I think the best case, theory they have now is that somebody absconded from a zoo with some kind of a large cat and then released it in the wild once he realized he couldn't keep it. So, you know, yeah, so there's all sorts of weird, crazy stories that I just couldn't quite kind of make fit into this book and the space that I have.
Mimi is in Midland, Texas. Welcome to the program. Hi, Mimi.
Hi, George.
Hey, thanks for holding so long.
Oh, I'm used to it. And thank you, Colin, for all of your research and good work. I've called to talk about Sarah Winchester.
All right.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorite people.
Yeah. My son and I toured the house about 15 years ago. And I think this lady went home with me.
Oh, boy.
Don't usually feel real personal. I mean, we hear all these things, but I have been personal about her ever since I was there. And so much is said about the house, but I don't think near enough is said about her. And
yeah.
she was truly brilliant. And
oh, yeah.
I think, yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I just think she was a very misunderstood person. And she had such grief. And of course, you touched on it, but, you know, she totally believed that she was somewhat afflicted or cursed by spirits of people that had been killed by the Winchester rifle. And that was her reason, you know, after she visited a medium or a psychic, you know, they told her, and this is kind of a Zen idea, but zigzagging and, you know, making all kind of detours and strange things in the house. That's why she did that, was to prevent any more harm from being done.
Was she a weird person, Colin?
You know, what's weird is that we actually don't know a whole lot about her. Her diaries haven't really survived. Her letters haven't really survived. We don't have a whole lot of firsthand accounts of what she was like, which I think is kind of strange. But I think the thing that I feel about Sarah Winchester is she was a real artist. You know, she was a self-taught architect, because women couldn't go to architecture school during that time, and, you know, she wouldn't, given the society that she was coming from. And she built this house basically kind of making it up as she went along, and she made this really, you know, magisterial, one-of-a-kind house. And I don't think she gets a lot of credit for being a really talented artist and architect in the way that, you know, I don't know, Frank Lloyd Wright or whomever, you know, sort of more formally trained and more sort of established. But, you know, she made this house, and the house itself is a work of art. And, you know, for all of the paranormal stories that, you know, get attached to it, I think it's important to remember that it's also just, it's just a stunning building. And she did it on her own by herself, and doesn't get enough credit for that, I think.
Robert in Tucson, Arizona. Let's get you in here, Rob. Thank you.
Hi, about the Gloucester Sea Serpent. I was actually born in Gloucester and lived there from the 1950s to the 1970s. The serpent's not been seen since the 1800s, but there is a small beach in Gloucester Harbor that has an imaginative painting of the sea serpent on a large rock.
Uh-huh.
Every 2 or 3 years, a local artist repaints it in vibrant colors because, you know, it wears out with the weather. You can do a Google search and find a photo of it if you try different keywords.
Okay.
But that's one thing I wanted to add about that.
I went out there, and it, you know what it reminds me of? If you play Dungeons and Dragons as a kid, the little ampersand between the dungeon and the dragon was sort of shaped like a little dragon breathing fire. It kind of looped around like that. That mural always reminded me of that because, yeah, it's this cool, really imaginative image, but he's kind of looped all around, like kind of coiled in this kind of cool way. That's kind of the association I always had with it when I saw that image.
Robert, the artist who paints it, does he do it by secret, or does everybody know who he is?
Oh, it's different artists over the years. I think it's been happening since the 1950s, so a different person will do it every few years, so there's a continuation. So the one that was done in the 50s was actually a slightly different style from the one you see now.
Interesting. And unless they breed, Colin, they probably died off, right?
I mean, I guess so. I mean, yeah, it's a real mystery as to why it would be something that was so clearly visible to so many people. And then, you know, after a couple of weeks, it just, you know, swam off, and that was the end of it, and hasn't been back since. I don't have a good answer for that one.
Colin, get your website out to folks, and the book is called The Unidentified. It's available right now, but tell us about the website.
So the website is just my name, colindickey.com, colindickey.com, and more information about Ghostland, the last book, and this one, The Unidentified, you can find it there. You can find me on social media. Say hello. I'm happy to talk more about this stuff.
Let's not let 3 years go by this time, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. This was a blast.
Thanks, Colin. Colin Dickey, you did a great job. His book is called The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.